Hey, everyone, it's Tanzina Vega, and you're with The Takeaway. The Trump Foundation is shutting down. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood announced the agreement on Tuesday. In a statement, Underwood accused the foundation of, quote, a shocking pattern of illegality that included unlawful coordination with Trump's presidential campaign. And now the foundation will be forced to return the money it has left and redistribute it to other charities under judicial supervision. Laura Namias, a reporter for Politico New York, has been following these developments. Laura, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
How much money are we talking about here?
Well, the charity has about $1.7 million left that they have to disperse. But if the charity dissolves, it won't be the end of the money that it has to pay out.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes. Attorney General Barbara Underwood is seeking millions of dollars more in restitution. This lawsuit is still ongoing. There may be additional penalties for the Trump Foundation or for President Trump and his children, subject to what happens in the lawsuit.
Now, the president is currently involved in many, many, many lawsuits.
So many
lawsuits. There's a lot of litigation happening right now. So just to make sure we understand this one specifically, what did New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood really accuse? What was she going after here?
So if you have a charity, if you run a charity in New York or in most other places, you have to agree that you're not going to engage in political campaigns, or that you're not going to use the charity to enrich yourself. It's sort of like the basic underlying principle of a lot of nonprofits and charities in the country and in New York State. So Barbara Underwood is accusing Donald Trump and the Trump Foundation of engaging in this pattern over many years of essentially using Trump Foundation donations to settle legal disputes for Trump's personal businesses, or even in some cases,
and for his own campaign, right?
Yes, and in one instance in particular, of essentially handing over the Trump Foundation's management to his presidential campaign during the early days of the 2016 race, making strategic donations in key primary states like Iowa. And as she alleges, doing it in order to influence the outcome of the presidential campaign and to further benefit Trump as a political candidate.
Well, speaking about that, the Trump Foundation attorneys have criticized Barbara Underwood for, quote, politicizing the investigation into their finances. What's with that?
Well, so the investigation started under former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who has since resigned after being accused of sexual misconduct. But Schneiderman was a Democrat and made no secret of going after Trump, not only on this matter, but he also sued Trump over Trump University. So the two have some history. But Barbara Underwood is a career prosecutor. She is not running for public office. She did not run to become attorney general. So the accusation of politicization here is less fitting than for somebody who maybe had aspirations to higher office at one point.
And you said this is going to go on. This is just the beginning of this lawsuit?
Absolutely. So the agreement to dissolve the foundation only settles one part of it. The lawsuit will continue, and Trump Foundation attorneys have said that they will continue to fight the other aspects of it.
Not a surprise. Laura Namias is with Politico New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When Wall Street nearly sank the global economy in 2008, U.S. taxpayers were forced to shore up the very firms that engineered the crisis. And out of all the financial firms responsible for taking markets to the brink, Goldman Sachs stood out for the sheer recklessness of its investments, but also because the bank emerged from the crisis relatively unscathed. But 10 years later, Goldman Sachs finds itself in the government's crosshairs again, this time facing one of the biggest threats in its 149-year history. Here to help us explain is Renee Merle, Wall Street reporter for The Washington Post. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Goldman Sachs has been in and out of trouble, as we mentioned, since 2008. What are they specifically being accused of now?
In this case, Goldman Sachs is being accused of being involved in an international scheme to defraud Malaysia of billions of dollars of money that was raised to help the people of Malaysia. Malaysia has this development fund. Goldman Sachs set up bonds that raised more than $6 billion. But over years, Malaysia realized that half of the money went missing. It was spent on different things. And now Malaysia has filed criminal charges alleging that Goldman Sachs lied and helped facilitate this fraud.
And what does Goldman Sachs have to say about these charges?
Goldman Sachs says they're not guilty, basically.
Surprised?
Not surprised at all. And they're basically saying that they were lied to and that this was the act of a couple of rogue employees, but that the company overall was not involved in some massive fraud.
I mean, Goldman Sachs has some of the smartest people in the world working there. So the idea that they had no idea seems somewhat off to me.
And that is really one of the threats that this case poses to Goldman Sachs. Because if Goldman Sachs can just pay a fine and move on from this case, it's going to be really a bump in their history. But if this leads to further investigations and questions about the reputation and the work ethic at Goldman Sachs, then it becomes a bigger deal. One of the former Goldman executives that's already been charged and actually pled guilty said, yes, he paid bribes and it was against the rules of Goldman, but he also said it was part of the culture of Goldman. And if regulators and law enforcement start looking into that aspect of it, is this part of a broader pattern at Goldman Sachs, then it becomes a bigger threat to the company overall.
So there are criminal charges potentially here. Are people going to go to jail? I mean, you mentioned Goldman. Where do you see that going?
So already there's been a guilty plea from a former Goldman official and another person who's been arrested in Malaysia, another former Goldman executive. And there are and the case is still going. So perhaps we could see criminal charges. We could see people actually going to jail. And that's a part of what makes this such an unusual case, that Goldman, the company itself, was charged criminally, which in the U.S. is just not something that happens very often. In this case, the criminal charges were filed by the government in Malaysia. In the U.S., we've always had this issue of not pursuing criminal charges against companies themselves. And of course, a company can't go to jail, but a criminal charge in a case like this, what it could lead to is that perhaps this company wouldn't be able to do certain types of businesses or other companies wouldn't be able to work with them. And so a criminal charge could be really crippling for a company.
Does Goldman bounce back from this, or we have to wait and see how far the investigation goes?
You know, I would never really bet against Goldman. Even a billion-dollar fine, a $2 billion fine, Goldman wouldn't break stride. It's a really big company with a really long history.
With a lot of money.
With a lot of money. And there's no reason to believe that they wouldn't be able to absorb even a really big fine. The greater risk to Goldman really is to their reputation. What one financial analyst told me, and I thought it was a great way to understand this, is what Goldman wants to avoid is contagion, that this case grows and leads to other investigations and leads to perhaps House Democrats calling Goldman CEO before Congress to talk to, you know, to ask questions about Goldman businesses, like opening the Pandora's box. If everybody remembers what happened to Wells Fargo 2 years ago, they had one problem where they were opening fake accounts for people. That led to one problem. But since then, they've had a series of running scandals, and they really haven't been able to grow since then. Regulators have been really tough on them. And that's the kind of fate that Goldman wants to avoid.
Renee Merle is a Wall Street reporter for The Washington Post. Renee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Images of Yalitza Aparicio on the cover of Vogue Mexico's January issue have already made the rounds on social media, and the results are stunning. Aparicio plays Cleo in Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, and the film is Aparicio's first. But it's not the first time a woman of color has broken through in the film industry by playing a maid.
I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you, and God bless you.
That was actress Hattie McDaniel accepting the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in 1940 for her role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind. On the day she accepted her Oscar, McDaniel had to get special permission to enter into the segregated venue where the ceremony was held in Los Angeles. She was then forced to sit at a small table in the back of the room while her white co-star sat up front at the Gone with the Wind table. So nearly 80 years later, the release of Roma got me wondering, has the film industry fully embraced women of color as more than just the help? And why did it take this film for us to see, or at least me, for the first time, to see an indigenous woman grace the cover of one of the most revered fashion magazines in the world? Joining me now to discuss is Soraya McDonald, culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Great to have you back, Soraya.
Thank you.
I don't want to start by saying all women of color enter Hollywood as the help, but we often have. What do you think about, why are these stories the ones that we're often tasked with telling?
There is a prevalent sort of trope of women of color playing maids or mammies or some sort of domestic help from the beginning of Hollywood, basically. And you see this celebrated with Hattie McDaniel's Oscar win for Gone with the Wind. But also around that same time, was an actress named Madame Sultawan, who actually had a part that was eventually like excised from the final cut of Birth of a Nation. And then after her, you see Louise Beavers and Nell Carter playing Beulah. So this trope comes up over and over again. You see it a lot with Black women, and you can sort of trace that back to Uncle Tom's Cabin and the character of Aunt Cleo. But you also see this with Latina women as well. You know, more recently, you could say, you know, one of Jennifer Lopez's like breakout film roles was Made in Manhattan. But even before her, Lupe Ontiveros played, I think, at least 150 different roles as maids, and just found it so difficult to break out of that typecasting.
And it was like maids, and Lupe was like a maid or like wiser old abuelita.
Right.
Similar to the way Black women are perceived as wise, you know, sassy Black woman friend and or help. And I just wonder, these roles, there's a weird tension here, right? Because these roles on the one hand have given women of color the opportunity to be in front of the camera. But I thought Hattie McDaniel's example was just so powerful, because at the same time, we're at the table, but literally she was not at the table. So where are we today with this? I mean, I want to bring up Viola Davis after what she said after doing The Help, because, and I'm quoting here, she said, at the end of the day, it wasn't the voices of the maids that were heard.
Who is telling the story and the perspective of the storytelling has a big difference on what we see and how these people are perceived. So a lot of times what's so troubling about these tropes is that these women are basically used as a springboard for another white character to come to some sort of personal realization. And so the story is really all about them. And these women of color basically function as accessories in their story. What's different about Roma is that it is really sort of centrally focused on Yalitza's character. And we are sort of processing what's happening in her life and the way the family that she works for basically sort of treats her as furniture. But we're not sort of being directed to identify with the family. We're being directed to identify with her character.
Right, and using the stories of Black women to do that.
Exactly.
Right? And when you say the Black women who helps the white character sort of come to this realization, I immediately thought of Sex and the City, the film, and sort of how that, you know, she was not a maid, but she was employed to help, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker's character get her life together, right?
Exactly, which sort of feeds into sort of a larger, like, magical Negro trope, which is basically, like, that's the sort of wise, sage Black person who's able to help this main white character in whatever
capacity.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's funny that you bring up Sex and the City, because as I was looking back yesterday, I don't know if you remember, there was one episode where Samantha has this boyfriend who has an Asian housekeeper named Som. And she is portrayed as being extremely deferential to him, almost like worshiping him, right? But she hates Samantha. And so you know, that dynamic is not much better. In that case, she's Asian, and she's basically sort of portrayed as this, like, angry, inscrutable Asian woman who is also manipulative, right? Because she's cruel to Samantha, like, behind the boyfriend's back.
All the dangerous stereotypes.
Exactly, right? She's a liar. She's manipulative. She's all of these things and is basically sort of touching on these underlying fears about, like, women of color coming in and not knowing their place and perhaps sort of sneaking in and, like, stealing, you
know. Being uppity, perhaps.
Being uppity, right.
But I'm wondering, and a couple of years ago for the New York Times, I did a story on Eva Longoria's show at the time, which was Devious Maids, where there were five maids, five Latina maids, and it was such an uproar after that. I talked to Eva about the decision to do that, and part of it was they were maids in character, but their characters were also really professionals, you know, behind, they were sort of posing as maids, and really most of them were attorneys and all this other plot twisting. I guess what I'd like to end with the question is there reality in the near future where women of color won't have to portray the help on the big screen in order to somehow get into Hollywood?
So I think we are seeing sort of incremental changes where you have young actresses now, like the lead actress in Gin, which was one of my favorite coming of age movies this year, who is playing like a Muslim girl who's basically sort of like figuring out her identity before she goes to college. And that was really a breakout role for that actress, Zoe Renee. But, you know, I would say There are more routes, especially because of the plethora of television roles that are available that maybe weren't, say, 10 years ago. That's another route. But it's still a road that exists.
Soraya McDonald is the culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get four hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, two savory premium pork chops, four chicken fried steaks, four Omaha Steaks burgers, four snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, four perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, four made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get four more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Where there are natural resources in this country, there's always been a fight to get there first.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. And my straw reaches and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up!
That race for access is playing out in Central California's wine region, where years of prolonged drought is taking a toll on underground aquifers. The limited fresh water that still exists is deep underground, and it's lured one investor looking to make a profit. That investor is Harvard University's multi-billion dollar endowment.
As our climate continues to change, water is becoming a very valuable substance. And in fact, there's more value to having acreage above basins that still have good water. And I think that's really what Harvard identified.
That's Russell Gold, a senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And he says this is ultimately a story about who gets access to water when that water starts to run dry.
We wanted to really take a hard look at how the changing climate was changing asset valuation. Where were things more expensive? Where were things less expensive? And I decided to take a look at water and water resources and stumbled upon this case of the Central Coast of California and this fascinating investment that Harvard's made.
So how is it that Harvard started buying land in California's wine region? What's that all about?
Well, Harvard has about $39 billion in their endowment and other investments. So they have to go out and invest and find good investments, you know, to get the returns that they're looking for. And a few years ago, one of the things that they decided to do was to increase what they call their natural resources investment. So they were going to go out and buy real assets as a way to invest, not stocks, not bonds, but actually go and buy things. And part of this was that they started investing in vineyards.
Vineyards. And where in California were they buying the land?
So this is on the Central Coast. It's actually about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. And it was in an area very close to Paso Robles, and it's part of the Paso Robles wine area. You know, it's not Napa, it's not Sonoma, but it's a real up-and-coming wine district, and there are a lot of wines that are produced there.
So what's the issue at stake here? I mean, it does, so far doesn't seem to be a problem.
Well, what happened, and I think kind of what got some people's noses bent a little, is that when they came in, they started making these very substantial purchases of land, and nobody knew exactly who they were. So the first thing I think that sort of surprised everyone and caught everyone's attention was, well, who are these people under an LLC going up and buying, you know, tens of thousands of acres of land or thousands of acres of land? And they couldn't get answers. It was about 2 years into this purchasing that people were able to connect the dots and realize, okay, this LLC is owned by the Harvard Endowment. So that was part of it. But the other bigger issue was that right about 2012, 2013, if you'll recall, this was during the height of the California drought. Water was a very big issue then and now in California. And the Paso Robles Basin was declining. There were some rural residents who relied on groundwater who were going to the County Board of Supervisors saying, you know, look, my well is gone. I need to deepen it. It's thousands of dollars. Water was becoming a real significant issue out there. And here was this company coming in, buying up all this land and drilling some of the deepest wells that the county had ever seen. You know, in one case, they drilled a well, they encountered water at 100 feet and they drilled 1,000 feet. Which was, as far as I can tell, one of maybe the 10 deepest wells ever drilled in that basin. So they were very aggressively staking a claim through their infrastructure on the water underneath Paso Robles.
And what's Harvard have to say about all this?
Well, Harvard declined to participate in my story. But, you know, they did point me towards some of their statements that they've made in the past. And essentially, what they've said is, look, we made this as an investment. We're interested in the agriculture out there. And of course, you know, water is important to agriculture. But essentially what they've said is this is an agricultural investment for us, period.
And are the actions of the Harvard Management Company in line with Harvard University's official stances on things like sustainability or like the environment or like ethical investing?
Well, that's actually very controversial. And one of the people I spoke to for my story, a former board of overseers, a member of Harvard's board of overseers named Kat Taylor, resigned just earlier this year because she said she did not feel that the endowment and the investments were being respectful of the human right to water was one of her primary reasons. So this is definitely an issue that Harvard needs to face. Now, presumably, they use the money, they use the endowments to support their educational mission, which includes a lot of research and a lot of good work. But the fact that they're coming in, the fact that they're staking a claim to water in one of the most, you know, water short regions of California in the United States certainly raises a big issue for them. You know, what exactly are they doing and what's their responsibility to, you know, the broader issue of sustainable water?
And what about going forward? I mean, water in California, obviously, as you mentioned, the year that this happened was during one of the highest moments of drought for that state. Water is becoming harder to come by. What does this story tell us?
It is, as the climate changes, there's more and more value to water. So what it tells me is that we're starting to see the emergence of investors, very sophisticated investors who are looking around and sort of saying, hey, we think that there's value in access to water, and we're going to take these steps right now. Now, in 10 and 20 years, when the rest of us sort of catch up to that and begin to say, hey, we don't have as much water as we used to, we need to take certain steps, Harvard and other investors have already staked that claim. So I think what you're seeing is some of the smarter money, some of the smarter investors getting ahead of where we all seem to be going.
Is that ethical? That's the big question.
Well, I think that's a question that needs to be posed to Harvard. I mean, we certainly tried to ask him about that, and there are many people in the Central Coast of California who were concerned about the ethics of it. Harvard's position it would be, yeah, we are acting ethically. We're growing grapes. You know, we're trying to be very water conscious. We're trying to be very, very water efficient. But, you know, when you then talk to some of the other people who are out there who have to spend $50,000 to drill their well deeper and can no longer afford to live where, you know, they thought they were going to retire, they certainly feel that Harvard is taking advantage of the situation, taking advantage of having a lot of money and influence to get what they want and sort of leave everyone else scraping around.
Russell Gold is a senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Russell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We also reached out to Harvard Management Company for a response, but in a statement, they said they do not comment on specific investments. I had one more thought for our listeners today. The holiday season is here, and that means lots of parties and the potential for lots of drinking. But what if you don't drink or you only drink moderately? It can lead to some really difficult choices. We've talked about alcohol on The Takeaway before, and we hope you listened to that episode. But further complicating this time of year is that many events center around alcohol and work and happy hours. And that's where a recent opinion piece by Andre Picard in the Globe and Mail caught my eye. Picard's take, if someone isn't drinking, it's none of your business. And I have to say, I agree. So I took to Twitter today to offer some tips on how to deal with these tricky situations. If you're entertaining, provide alternatives like mocktails, soda, and juices. Stop making every event an alcohol-centered event. Remember that some people may not want to go to happy hour. And there's more. So we want to hear from you. Tweet me at Tanzina Vega to share your thoughts, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.